Okay. Learn, do, share. The conversations.
Hi everyone, this is the Learn, Do, Share Changemaker Conversation number 3, and I'm here with Gunther Sonnenfeld today and Dr. Joanne Jakovic. Both of your work is concerned with social innovation, Joanne from an urban development lens and Gunther from a business development perspective. One factor that unites you is your constant search for creative ways to change people's ways and ethos when working together. So this conversation is really free form. Joanne, would you like to kick it off by giving us a short statement on why your area is important or exciting, or what are you curious about in Gunther's work?
Okay. Thanks, Ayla, for the introduction, and hello, Gunther.
Hello.
So we are really interested in how to make better cities and how to make more collaborative, human-centered environments for us to live in and to work in. So we often see that cities are designed in a very top-down way, and there's some frustration, especially in first-world cities, for the lack of impact you can make on the city and the lack of flexibility you have to adopt and adapt new ways of making the city. And our work's really exciting because we're taking people out of that mindset and offering them tools to activate the city, collaborate together, come up with new ideas, get them going with sort of an entrepreneurial support network, and work with government and different sort of planners to actually see things begin to get enacted. So we call that crowd share innovation, because often what we're doing is giving a process that's very kind of linear open access to the crowd. And it's not a sort of an online crowdsourcing approach. It's crowd sharing, which means highly intensive face-to-face physical prototyping, enacting and role-playing, and then going into making real products. So, Gunther, I'd be interested to hear about what you do and how you work with social innovation.
Well, it's, you mentioned something interesting, which I think is sort of a macro problem, which is, our world, at least through industry, is constructed through hierarchies, right? So there's sort of two layers of breaking down hierarchies, if you want to call it that, and one is at sort of the meta level, which is through information and information systems, and the other one is through the collaborative level, such as what you're talking about. And I think the essence of what we do, and we meaning sort of our sort of, small network, is to basically attack it at both angles by understanding context in terms of what is the meta, or what are first best questions around what's going on in the marketplace. What are sort of the systemic or ecosystemic problems at play that might not have been thought of before through normative research? That's one, and that comprises using fusing different types of disciplines around cultural and digital anthropology and primary and secondary research. And then the second part, which you talked a lot about, which is the collaborative aspect. So once we understand context in a new light, what happens in a room between stakeholders that's going to actually get us to develop solution sets, whether that's an actual technological prototype or something more akin to an idea set that's going to allow people to kind of build and scale and think about things in a longer term fashion. So the essence of our work is really around that. It's on one hand context, and the other part, the storytelling aspects of what context means, and using scenarios and role playing, as you described, produce either a set of solutions or to conjure a set of outcomes, possible outcomes.
Is that something you use a lot, Joanne, in your workshops, storytelling and application in a business environment or government environment? Does that really work out? Are people open for that?
I think people are doing and using storytelling without calling it that. And most people are really aware that pitch is really important in order to communicate an idea well. So in a way, what we do is highly structured interactions that give people a chance to develop more complex and more convincing and more articulate stories, and ones that have a description of motivation behind them, because that's usually what captures the audience. So, yeah, I think people are open to that. And I do think, though, in terms of context and looking for our understanding, often context is depicted and set by a governmental sort of planning system. So trying to understand that context and pitch a story to aim to that understanding or to aim to that audience is the more difficult part. So I think people are very good at communicating stories amongst their peers and bringing people on board with ideas, but talking across paradigms or up at different levels, as you said, into the meta level as opposed to sort of the more human level, is the more difficult part. And that's where you can really make change, when you learn to speak within those two layers. What do you think, Gunther?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's about finding commonality. So it's interesting what you brought up in terms of storytelling. I agree. I think storytelling is ingrained. It's just part of human discourse. It's existed for centuries. It's how we express ourselves. And I think people are sort of, biologically and genealogically given to telling stories. But regarding context, one of the things that we're working on very intensely is understanding how context operates at the human level, meaning, what are the motivations and intentions of people when they tell stories? What are the values on the ground and out in a universe of, whether it's a city or a nation or government system that compels people to act in a certain way. And then once we understand that, what are the actions on the ground that are actually measurable in terms of value? So what I mean to say by that is, one of the big problems with big data is not just the fact that there's tons of information, right? And the term is very elusive. The thing is what does data mean within context, the operable context in the confines or within the parameters of a system of local rules, such as a city or a community of people, and what happens when different questions are asked and different outcomes are thought through or acted out. What happens next? How do you take those learnings and manifest them into something that's tangible and applicable? And I think that's the central challenge, particularly in business, right? Where people haven't thought about policy, they haven't thought about outcomes, they haven't thought about the ecosystemic consequences of what they're doing. That's really it. So at the very core of it, it's a mind shift. Because to your point, they're given to telling stories, but what they're not, I think where the fear sets in is when they realize, oh my God, like I haven't thought through all these scenarios and there's a lot at stake here. There's a lot to think about. They personalize it almost in a way. What's been your experience in that with design in particular?
With the experience of people moving from those systemic and big data kind of level, you mean, down to that system of local rules?
I think, well, that, but also just, I think it's really the fear set, when they're faced with some of the information that's presented to them, I think fear settles in and they're sort of overwhelmed in a way, I think there's an art in presenting the information in a way to them that's very tangible, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, definitely. working within a very large bureaucracy, as in my current place of employment at university, we're often consulting to other different kinds of large organizations and large bureaucracies. So I think, the tendency is, if they have the fear and if the scenarios begin to become obvious and play it out, there's often a withdrawal. There's not an empowered engagement with that challenge, and there is a withdrawal into the high levels of abstraction where management structures get built, problems get solved in old ways rather than new ways. And, you know, that's the case here in Sydney in any way. Do you know what I mean? Does that happen in your experience?
I totally, yes. And I think that's predominant. I'll give you an example of an exception. We just met with a group, we'd call it a mid-sized company. They probably do about $1 billion in revenues, on the rise. They're based in Mexico, which is an emerging economy. A lot of people don't know that Mexico is actually kind of a boom economy. They're graduating a lot of engineers and thinkers and critical thinkers, liberal arts people. Cost of labor is cheap. So as an economy itself, it's a thriving place. So long story short, we met with a group down there, and it was kind of surprising to me in a way. They were really sort of open and less fearful of things. And the collaborative aspects, even though there's a lot of management hierarchy within the organization, they were very, very sort of not only open to asking these types of questions and exploring, but they had a pretty solid cultural dynamic in terms mm-hmm. of collaboration and things not. So when we mentioned things to them like scenarios and open design and things of that nature, they didn't really flinch. The biggest fear factor for them was literally, what do we do next? So let's say we get to all these scenarios and everything's hunky-dory in terms of understanding the nature of things. What then? I said, well, then we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. So in other words, the assembly line mentality, letting go of that and knowing that there's an open canvas seemed to be the biggest sort of cognitive hurdle for them, which was kind of interesting. Not the fact that they were ready to do the experimentation pieces.
Yeah, so. And do you find that those kinds of organizations are looking for, how can I say, like a process or something that will give them, maybe not assembly line, but some kind of structure to the what do we do next question?
I think so. Any large organization, any institution is given to structures, right? I don't think you can start talking about model-free, emergence and things like that. Their eyes will glaze over. But yeah, they're definitely looking for structures. And I think what you kind of slip in is, hey guys, that structure is adaptive, by the way. It's going to change. The values are going to change. The inputs and the throughputs and all that stuff. And, you don't have to tell them that. You kind of guide them through an experience and they see the value and they're just kind of open to the next step, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? Does that sound kind of familiar?
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Ella?
That's where I would have a question. Because these methods, a core or central question that you're also referring to, Gunther, is obviously what happens when it comes to collaborative decision making, ideas crystallization. Maybe both of you would be interesting if you wanted to share secrets of your experiences, what really worked well to get groups to make a decision.
You hit them over the head with a hammer.
I have no secrets and probably few successes. Collaborative decision making, I think, is really difficult. Collaborative idea making is very easy, and
totally.
Envisioning and even planning is easy. But when it comes to responsibility and enactment, that is when there isn't really the sort of a great deal of those adaptive structures that you mentioned, or even closer to the emergent structures that can enable the energy and the dynamism that occurs in the idea phase to follow through into the sort of decision making and responsibility phase.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, and I think to build on that, I think what happens, which is quite interesting, is that the hierarchies that are in place are empowered. So specifically, what I mean by that is, in the role playing phases of a storytelling exercises or an open ideation, a series of exercises, you start to see, the dominant types, the subdominant types, and the leaders emerge in those situations, and And so basically what happens is they defer to you on the next set of decisions in a way, or what the directive should be. And then the decision makers make the decisions, and then they're off kind of to the races. And then you go on to the next set of ideation. So I think that's structurally, that's what hierarchies are good for, right? It's the creative part that's been constricted all these years. So it seems like, at least, I don't know.
I don't know. As an educator with, you know, master's level students, I often have discussions with them about how inhibiting and sort of controlling the whole educational model can be to their empowerment and to their learning and to them drawing on a much deeper sense of intelligence and a wider and broader sense of knowing. And I think organizations and that hierarchy, that decision-making hierarchy, is something that does kind of just subtly keep people in their place, even if people might be imagining they're going through collaborative decision making and working in an adaptive manner. I still haven't really seen a way to enhance the capacity of people better within that hierarchical model, and I often wonder what is the fluid, emergent, non-hierarchical model of management and of business that could enable a lot more.
Well, no, it's a fair point. I should clarify. I agree with that. So for the current structures that are in place, you sort of empower the leadership, knowing that there's a creative process, and what happens over time. Ideally, is that they start to see that the ideation phases can open up their mind, and they can actually defer decision making powers to other people within their group or their division. I think on an ongoing basis, right, and, you know, the longer term, ideally what you want is a bunch of leaders that own specific decision-making domains or knowledge domains that are sort of flat organizationally, right?
Yeah.
But they own decision sets. And unfortunately, that just doesn't work in most industry, just because of the way the economic variables are set up and, you know, organizational variables are set up. But that's kind of what you would want. In some instances, what they'll do is they'll form coalitions, right, or committees, if you will, where you can do that, and where there is ownership of domain and whatnot. Interestingly, the work I've done in the nonprofit space is the exact opposite. You have everything is trial by committee, and no one can make a decision, but it's very flat. So you have flat structure, but you have no sort of command over organizational. So the command and control setup is just is controlled by the group, and there is no command.
I ask you a question then? How is there a new hybrid where you can have the coalitions and committees, if that's what you'll call them, mm-hmm. where decision making is rapid? It's got responsibility attached to it. You know, is there some kind of active model that's working that does that?
Gosh, there is. I don't know if it's one model. There's sort of a set of models that do work. I think at the very high level, if you want to talk about Fortune, you know, the Fortune 100, Fortune 1000s, what they'll do is they'll form co-ops. Where they bring in different stakeholders. For companies that are a little bit tightly organized, meaning they don't have quite as many employees or quite as many divisions, I've seen success where you form a new division and you hire domain experts completely from the outside. In other words, there's no internal stakeholders actually managing that business or that process. At least at the decision-making level, and that tends to work. In a nonprofit sense, I haven't seen anything that was successful, but I haven't worked with as many nonprofits to know, and that would include, you know, educational, educators, institutions, people like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So would that mean that situational leadership, like, have you got experience or seen situational leadership being assumed by people in certain situations, certain power relationships? Would that be a way out?
Well, so I can't speak to the educational space. I do teach, but I don't have the kind of experience that Joanne has. But I can say on the corporate side, I have seen success with what we call co-ops, meaning you set up a unit or a division that sits outside of the core structure of the corporation, and you bring in people from the outside. So let me give you a tangible example. Like when I was at the ad agency, my last gig, my executive gig, we had a division out of Brazil, and you know, we were doing some really interesting work with digital anthropology. And long story short, the guy who started this whole thing tried to implement a structure inside the organization, which failed. And then he created a separate business unit, rebranded it, brought stakeholders from the outside. What I mean by that, domain experts. So these were like economists, journalists, writers, artists, musicians, literally brought them into the room. We were studying the data, evaluating complex problems, and bringing company stakeholders, clients in. And then we would literally rapidly assess problem sets and solution sets within a matter of hours. It worked beautifully. And it actually ended up being the most profitable division in the entire network, which was, I guess, not so ironic. So that was a classic example of how that could work. But again, you had to go outside of the superstructure, as it were, which was the core, you know, corporate organizational hierarchy, and bring people entirely from the outside. And Joanne, I would imagine where you guys kind of are a phenomenal layer to that, you know, even if you're within academic fold, is when you come into situations where you're saying, look, we've got all these smart people that are not part of the day-to-day, and look what we can do together. Is that fair to say or not?
That's what we're offering, really, when we do work with the corporate organizations, a way to open up their innovation processes to different talent. So, yeah, and we're finding that a lot of companies are very open to bringing lots more diversity to the table when they're making those kinds of decisions. So that's really encouraging.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So basically, and we have a similar model. You pull from a network, either one that's internal or external. I'm just speaking in terms of like people you deal with day to day. It just depends on the problem or the domain, and then you bring them in, and it's kind of fresh, and you have a process, and you do your sort of open design thing. Is that kind of how it goes down? In a way,
most of the time we are openly publicly advertising, so we're working on an attraction model where people who are interested in the topic are coming along, and they're operating as public design workshop events, in which, you know, there's a company sponsoring it who has a problem that needs to be sort of opened out to a broader mindset and mind group. So we are trying not to fall back into bringing on specialists and people within our network, but in fact opening it up to the noise in the system.
Got it.
But, you know, that has its faults as well, because you only really attract the ones who are passionate, interested, engaged, forward-thinking. So we're not really getting a full sweep of a wider demographic, but it's really, really exciting.
So your people sourcing, and then what about, and this might be a dumb question, but do you hybridize the model as well? I mean, do you have some specialists that can anchor some of the core problem identification, how does that work? Do you have like conductors that you know, conduct some of the ideas that come in, or the people that come in from the outside, or what? How does that work exactly?
Well, we normally run it in a phased program where there'll be a completely public open interaction session with up to maybe 100 people.
Okay.
And then we'll move from this very public one into what we call a private private think tank or a private design workshop, where we will still have the external conductors or specialists and people who we think, who we've either met at one of our events and thought that would be an ideal person to have within that context or that topic, or otherwise who are already in the network. And so the second level is a bit more curated, and then we often just work with the company directly after that to see where they take it internally, because Often when you when we start working with really enormous organizations, they bring in their, you know, quite sort of senior people because they can only really they can't bring too many managers in, so they bring in quite either dynamic ones or senior ones or up and coming ones. But then they need to go in and spread the method or their decisions into their different sections or groups. So that's, you know, a whole different kind of level of, you know, beginning to move that open crowdsource innovation into their internal organization.
Interesting. And I imagine there's a vetting process too, right? Like, so you mentioned you would meet some people that you would bring in as domain experts after. Was that just based off the cuff? Not off the cuff, but just, you know, sort of conversations that you had in an intimate setting, or is there an actual vetting process that you guys use?
No, we'd say it is off the cuff, and we treat them more as provocateurs rather than as experts within the process. Huh. So the experts are the people we're working with in the organization.
Sure.
So, okay. Yeah. So one question I was going to ask, if you could give me your thoughts on, when you're talking about big data, how mm-hmm. you see the impact of things like social media and Web 2.0 in impacting and influencing the collaborative. So if you're moving between the meta and the collaborative, mm-hmm. how you can have more impact or have different kinds of emergent ideation or decision making happen mm-hmm. by some kind of skillful interaction between that physical collaborative place and that social data environment.
That's a great question.
Well, it's something that I think from a city perspective, city governments are really trying to tap into at the moment, because a lot of the good stuff that happens in cities happens in a physical sense. So it's the events, the great bars, the parties, exhibitions, installations, all these kinds of things. But in a way, sometimes the energy that's used in activating and enhancing the city by the bottom-up and grassroots activists or activators is kind of not leveraged and not spread as far as it could be. And but then there's this whole other sort of world happening in the Twitter sphere and the Facebook and all the rest, which is a very enormous scale, and it's following these things but not necessarily contributing to it as much as it could, especially in terms of building culture and activating a sort of a more creative participatory environment, both for business and for individuals.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So kind of going back to something you said earlier about having, when you people source both the people and the ideas themselves, and you have, let's say, a sample set of 100, people, we look at the internet as a giant focus group. Mm-hmm. And we look at it as an intelligence ecosystem. And what I mean by that is, like, social media has often been thought of as this thing that's sort of like a push communication thing. And, you know, maybe it's one-to-one, maybe it's one-to-many, many-to-many. But what we look at it as more of an intelligence thing, sort of like collective intelligence. And specifically, when you talk about different domain areas, I mean, first of all, our approach to using the tools and the way we've constructed the software is predicated on common or direct or latent interests, right? So we look at influence not as, you know, how big your megaphone is or how many people you're connected to or you talk to. We look at influence in terms of content networks, interest networks, and knowledge, right? Knowledge mm-hmm. basis. And the way we set up what we call tribes are predicated on those factors. So all the nodes within the network are based on pivots that pertain to, subject matter. So for example, you know, we have over 450 influence tribes based on literary interests, right? And they're connected to other tribes and they're connected. So in true network analysis, that's how we look at it. So in terms of like getting people together, let's say that same 100 people that you described are gathering around solving the problem of green energy in civic systems. I'm just going to speak yep. arbitrarily. what we would do with the data is go look at all the tribes associated with green civic design as primaries, and then secondary and tertiary sets would be around sustainability initiatives, open architecture, open design, and there's tribes like you know, along the tail, so to speak, there are, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of tribes. So we would coordinate those, we would identify those groups online through social media specifically, and we would follow the conversation, and we would start to create a tapestry around what they're talking about and build insight around those connections through, yep, through not just common interests, but also what are some latent things that aren't being discussed, and kind of bring that in and coordinate it in a way and develop some insights. Bring that into a group setting and say, here's what we found out in the universe that pertains to you guys. And here's what people that are like you or connected to you in the, through these interests are saying, basically in a nutshell, and, mm-hmm, and kind of procure the intelligence in a way that makes sense and sparks conversations so that the interpersonal interactions and physical spaces have much deeper meaning. And in some cases, I would say in most cases, what we do is we actually highlight some areas of interest that are kind of either, I don't want to say off the wall, but just things that you wouldn't commonly think of. Yeah. Based on that approach. So, yeah,
and,
that's kind of
good. Are you, how big are your influence tribes? Like, and how fluidly are they forming? Is it something that you formed, you know, as you mentioned, sustainability, open architecture, open design, that kind of thing? How do they come about?
The deep mining is done through curation. So we curate the conversations, and then of course we allow the technology to accelerate sort of the natural language processing portions of it. If I understand the nature of the question, what we do is we basically, when we start to see patterns early on, we take the data and then we use research on the ground. So we'll enlist, an anthropologist, for example, to ask deeper questions about what's going on in that ecosystem, questions with real people. They give us feedback or they give us some insight and then we'll go back. So, in short, it's a combination of the machine, the technology itself, and the insights that we gather back from people on the ground that we're talking to, and then we kind of just develop it. And then typically what happens is if we start doing collaborative sessions, for example, right, let's just say it's with the Green Sustainability Group and we have open ideation, we start to see some very interesting insights early on and patterns which we put back into the tool itself, and we start to see more associations tribally out in the social sphere. So it's just an ongoing thing that scales, which is kind of cool.
And are the end users or the consumers of the insights you're finding, mm-hmm, are they the organizations and sort of corporate scale brands you're working with, or are they, how's the knowledge used?
It's the knowledge is used both. It's the clients and the brands and the organizations, but it's also just developing deeper associations with different groups out in the world, depending on who it is. Yeah. So it's less on that end as it should be, simply because we're just we're trying to put a stake in the ground in terms of moving the needle of business, if you will. But the good news is that the knowledge itself and the insights are put into a database, and what we've been doing lately, particularly on the venture side, is using the intelligence to go to institutions, academic institutions, where we either help teach or run courses, and we try to socialize the intelligence. So in other words, if there's a whole green movement, sustainability movement out there with multiple dimensions, we show them what that looks like, we procure the insights, and we try to develop curricula around that. And that's kind of the idea. We haven't done a lot of it, but we've done some of it, a little bit of it. So we hope because you guys in your domain, right, the academics and people out there and students and people who are deeply invested in the stuff day to day, who are not thinking about selling stuff and making widgets, are the research hubs of the world. And, academia is not set up to be open like that, as you know, but we would love it if there was a syndicate of networks around the world based on different domains where you just tap into that as a resource pool, and everybody benefits from it, right?
Yeah, I agree. Fabulous. You know, if I was a chancellor of the university, I'd be enacting your wishes immediately.
Awesome. Which brings me maybe if you allow, this is so exciting, it could run, let this run forever. But maybe we, let me come to my last question, and it's a perfect segue that you just gave me. In one or two sentences, what's the one, or if you could choose one obstacle that would magically disappear, what would that be?
Do we have 10 seconds to think? I mean, I can't choose my best obstacle. I mean, there's too many.
Oh, sorry, say that again. I talked to you.
There's so many obstacles.
Yeah.
No, there isn't. Do you have something, Gunther?
Oh, I honestly, I go back to fear. I just wish I could remove fear. I think it's the number one thing. The capacity and the potential for most people when you get them in these situations, as you know, particularly with collaboration and they see ideas manifest before their eyes and their imagination is sparked, and that transcends being right-brained or left-brained of an engineer or a thinker. It doesn't matter. If you could just remove the fear factor up front, in most cases, it's just wondrous what can happen. I mean, there's so much resistance from people in decision-making positions that it's tough to deal with sometimes, frankly. It just is. And, you know, they hire you for your expertise, but they don't want to hear, you know, or they don't want to be open to certain things. It's not always the case, but anyways. That would be the one.
Maybe
thing.
I'll add to that, because that's a very good and obvious sort of big hurdle that we all face. And perhaps if we could remove time, Ela, I think that a lot of people don't operate based on the current and the future. They kind of, like Gunther was pointing out, they operate based on what they know in the past and the experiences of failure in the past. And if you kind of remove that relational sort of way, impact on how you make decisions, if you didn't have the past as something that could impact your future, then you could see yourself making better decisions, because you just look at the most optimistic or positive, productive option, rather than the past, which may have been one that happened in the past, which may have been, less successful, but one that you know. So if we could somehow operate in a time-free environment, I think, we wouldn't be dealing with fear so much. I think it would be eradicated.
I love it. I love it.
Love it. So fear and time. I love two very deep and meaningful thoughts at the end. Thanks for that deep dive. I have a lot of inspiration that I take away. And thank you very much for taking the time. That was awesome.
Thank you, Ela.
Yeah, thank you, Ela.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.